I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're thinking about it, chances are we're talking about it on WHYY's Radio Times.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
The French government and the U.S. Holocaust Museum recently announced that a memorial will be erected at Rivesaltes in France. That was the site of the notorious internment camp near the Spanish border, where Jews and others were held during the Second World War. The conditions at the camp were miserable, where prisoners suffered from cold, disease, and hunger. Thousands of Jews from Rivesaltes were sent to Auschwitz. It's estimated that some 70,000 Jews were sent from France to concentration camps for extermination during the war. There were many children at Rivesaltes, including my guest, Henry Perrins. It was in the early 1940s, and he was there with his mother, who later convinced him to escape. He made his way to Marseille, where he was cared for by a children's organization, which later sent him to America, where he was raised by a foster family. Dr. Perrins is a Philadelphia-based psychiatrist and psychoanalyst. He specializes in treating children. He's a professor of psychiatry at Thomas Jefferson University. And he wrote a book a bit back about his childhood, about how those experiences have shaped him as an adult. The book is called Renewal of Life, Healing from the Holocaust. Dr. Perrins, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Good morning.
Nice to be here with you, Marty.
And to our listeners, lines always open at 1-888-477-9499. You begin your book with a three-word sentence, and it says, "The Holocaust happened." When I read that, I thought, gosh, in 2006, you know, 60 years after the Second World War, you still have to write that sentence.
I felt I had to. For a number of reasons, there are still some people who don't know that it happened or attempt to deny that it happened. And I also said it for emphasis. I didn't know how to really open up. So I took us right there with the Holocaust happened.
And since you lived through the Holocaust and you had family members who died during the Holocaust, is it with you all the time?
All the time. It's built in. It's a part of life. We all carry with us the effects of our past traumas. We also carry with us the effects of being loved and being cared for. But it becomes part of our character, really. In some ways, it becomes part of our general mood, you know.
And how you view the world, I guess.
Oh, absolutely. How you view the world is very critical. And one of the things that I particularly take from it is, from my experience, has been how awful we human beings can be to each other. And side by side with that is how courageous and giving human beings can be with each other.
Is that why you're a psychiatrist?
Well, in part, yes. I became a psychiatrist quite consciously, because I knew that the children suffer. You know, this was at a time when people used to not deny that children suffer. They forgot their own childhoods, you know. And yes, I went into psychiatry to help children, tolerate the kinds of things that I had tolerated in one way or another.
Well, let's go back to your childhood, and you describe in your book, you lived with your parents were divorced, you lived with your mother in Brussels.
Right.
This was May 10th, 1940, the Germans attack Belgium. You're actually at a summer camp, but are sent, along with your family and many others, to France. What, sent to France thinking that you and your family would be safer there?
Oh, absolutely, and we ourselves took ourselves to France. We were not sent there by anyone. We got on the train ourselves in chaos. You didn't need tickets for the train. You just got on the train. We were going to France, to southern France. And we got to the environs of Toulouse when we were disembarked and distributed among villagers.
Who, as you describe, were very generous people.
Very generous.
People very warmly and helped care for all these families on the run.
Absolutely. You know, this is just a point that I was making, that while such horrible things were going on, some very good things were going on. And, you know, I recall, I can see the people coming toward the train with sandwiches.
Really?
When we just arrived in southern France.
Now, you were just, 11 years old at the time.
Yes.
Did you have any way of knowing what was going on? I mean, obviously, kids at that age, they look to their parents to sort of gauge what's going on in the world.
Yeah. I recall at that time, I did not recognize the vastness of what was happening.
Right. Did your mother, though?
Do you think? Yes, my mother
did. She understood.
Well, bear in mind that this was now 1940, and that on November 9, 1938, Kristallnacht was really the big, you know, the night of the broken crystals, was really a very clear signal to the Jews of Europe as to what the intentions of Hitler were, intentions that he had declared in his Mein Kampf, in his My Battle, you know, his book, which he wrote while he was in prison.
And you saw graffiti, I'm sure, and
oh, graffiti, absolutely. I walked by graffiti every day going to school and coming back.
How did your mother, though, talk to you about that? And I think, you know, all parents try to figure out how much should a child know, especially a young child know, yes. But at the same time, when something as horrifying as the Holocaust, the Second World War, is gathering steam, and even as a psychiatrist, what do you think children should know?
I think children should know the truth, whatever it is. They don't need to know your personal truth, but mm-hmm. they do need to know the truth about what's going on. My mother had was a brave woman, and she trusted me, but at the same time, she was a little afraid of the whole truth. And so she tried to lower the degree of danger, if you will. I really didn't become cognizant. I read danger in her reactions. So that, for example, when we, in chaos, left Brussels, I could see that she was very upset, very, very stressed out.
And maybe even just holding her hand, you could
absolutely.
Feel the grip of her hand.
Absolutely, sure. And when she told me that she wanted me to escape from Rivesaltes, boy, that was serious. I knew that was serious business.
Now, your family, you and your mother were first, and others were sent to a first concentration camp, or I guess an internment camp, and you describe the idleness, the sheer boredom, of, especially being a young boy in a camp with literally nothing to do.
Oh, absolutely. And by the way, the French called the camps concentration camps.
Oh, they did?
Yes. We were first in Recebédou, which was the first camp. And you're right. I really learned how prolonged summer vacations really tire fairly quickly. And one of the real challenges for us kids was, what do we do with our time?
Right. So what did you do with your time?
Well, we played some games. We developed a Boy Scout troop within the camp. Some of the parents got together and gave us some lessons in, you know, they were very few and far between. But mostly it was really, what do I do now?
Yeah. But does it also tell you something about children and the potential resilience of children, or the creativity of children to, as you say, play games and create fantasy experiences for yourself?
You're really touching on an issue that I'm currently working on, and that's the issue of resilience.
Right.
I think that my book is a study in resilience. I'm a little wary of saying that because I don't want to sound immodest, but the fact is that it is a study in resilience. And you're right. In the camps, we played.
Yeah.
You know, children will play no matter where they are, whether in a hospital, in a concentration camp. And it's part of our attempt to master the situation that we're in.
Well, and you and your friends played the Three Musketeers, right?
Yes.
As a way of what, mastering you were in?
You can imagine who the enemies were.
Yes.
I mean, after all.
And you had swords. And
absolutely. We had swords and we played the Three Musketeers, and, you know, the Nazis were our victims.
You described this first concentration camp, and then your family was moved, your mother and yourself and others, to another camp, Rivesaltes.
Rivesaltes, yes.
How is that different from the first place?
It was dramatically different. The first place were brick barracks. They were there for the duration. They were red bricks, you know. In the Rivesaltes, everything was wood. It was gray. And some of it was falling apart already at the time. At the foot of the Pyrenees Mountains during the wintertime, yes, it's very cold. You know, many people don't realize the latitude that France
is. It's very north, isn't it?
It's at the equivalent of Boston. Southern France is the equivalent of Boston.
So you remember being cold and hungry?
Oh, yes. Cold. We were starving. I mean, you know, we had a famous diet of one piece of bread in the morning and some watery soup at lunchtime. We couldn't tell what the vegetables were. And then a piece of bread again in the evening, occasionally a piece of vegetable. Rutabaga, you know, rutabaga
is
the food they feed pigs in France. Well, that's what they fed us.
And then the Jews were separated even further from others in Rivesaltes.
I learned that the Jews were not the only ones who were incarcerated by the French. Bear in mind, we're in Vichy France now.
Yes.
We're in southern France. But there were many Spanish refugees from the Franco War, you know, the Civil War there. And, of course, they also incarcerated gypsies. And when Passover approached, they decided to put the Jews in a separate island from the rest of the camp. I like to quip that what would have happened if they had given a Spaniard a piece of straw matzah?
And that's what you had?
Virtually, really. It really tasted like straw.
Right. Yeah. We're about a minute away from our first break, but your mother, and it was, I won't say shocking to read, but just amazing to read. She decided, and you're a kid, you know, you're 12 years old, and she wants you to escape from this camp, Rivesaltes.
Right. My heart is full for my mother. I mean, I have the greatest love and respect for her. She was a very brave woman, and when the time came, she knew that she had to send me away. You know, by then things, how they got news from what was happening in the East, I really don't know, but no doubt somebody got news of Babi Yar and, you know, the killings and that were going on of the Jews and open graves and just shot into them. So at the time, that is the early 1941, my mother felt that at one point she just came to me and said she wanted me to escape.
And she probably thought also that you could get ill or even maybe even starve or be sent away from Rivesaltes.
Certainly, and which eventually happened.
Right.
You know.
I'll tell you what, we're going to take a very short break and get back to our guest, Dr. Henry Perrins, our guest today on Radio Times. He's a psychiatrist, psychoanalyst, and he specializes in parenting, education in children, also something he calls malignant prejudice. And he has written a book about his life called Renewal of Life, Healing from the Holocaust. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
I'm Mike McGrath. On the next You Bet Your Garden, I'll help you figure out if your creepy crawly new friends are millipedes or centipedes and what to do about them. Plus, how tomato plants defend themselves against pests and chemical-free answers to an especially large selection of your garden questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY 91 FM.
There's more than one side to a story.
This report indicates that Latino immigrants have far more negative attitudes toward black Americans than do the whites.
There are black Latinos.
It looks more like it's a struggle of class as opposed to just race and ethnicity.
I'm Ed Gordon for important issues and a variety of views. Join me at the Roundtable on News and Notes from NPR News.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
Fresh Air is celebrating the extended holiday weekend with a country music series. Our series begins on the next Fresh Air with the Dixie Chicks and father and son singers and songwriters Daryl and Wayne Scott. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
I'm famous to my...
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM. They all know I could.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. The French government and the U.S. Holocaust Museum recently announced that a memorial will be erected at Rivesaltes in France, and that's the site of the notorious internment or concentration camp near the Spanish border where Jews and others were held during the Second World War. Many children were at Rivesaltes, including my guest, Henry Perrins. He was there with his mother, who later convinced him to escape from Rivesaltes. He's a Philadelphia-based psychiatrist and psychoanalyst. He specializes in treating children. He's a professor of psychiatry at Thomas Jefferson University, and he wrote a book about his life called Renewal of Life, Healing from the Holocaust. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I found it interesting, your description of escaping from Rivesaltes. Didn't seem that difficult. I mean, you had to wait for the right time and the right place.
Right. But no, it didn't. It wasn't difficult. It was scary.
Yeah.
But it wasn't difficult. And, you know, in that day, under these conditions, children, adolescents particularly, did things that one would not expect in peace times, you know, to consider. Judy Kessenberg and Ira Brenner have written a book in which they report on child survivors. And Judy makes a point that adolescents in that era did things that surprised themselves as well as adults, some of them faring better than some of the grown-ups. So... you know, to say that I escaped from the camp, and you're right, it was not that difficult. It was risky.
Yes, and you were by yourself.
And I was, well, that was the big thing.
Yes, I mean, well, I would think, because here you are, 12 years old, yeah?
I was 12 years old, and when my mother, you know, said that she wanted me to escape, I said, fine, with you, I'll go anywhere, right. You know. But no, she meant for me to go alone. But when I think now, you know, I have 5 grandchildren, and two of them are 13, two boys. My granddaughter is 11, and when I think of my Lord, that's the age I was, and I must confess that I cannot envision they're doing what we absolutely had to do because of the times.
Well, and you had to get yourself on a train and not be discovered, and got to Marseille, where there was this organization for children.
Right. Yes.
And just through your own wits and I'm assuming there's a degree of luck in all this as well?
Oh, there's no question about that. No matter who we are, where we are, luck always plays its part, negatively or positively. The escape was very, very scary, even though it was quite simple. I ran as fast as I could. I got to a road, and I found a ditch, and I walked along a ditch to the city where I was going, which was Perpignan, about 15 kilometers. And then I bought my ticket. I had to hid
in a
public toilet, where, for, you know, people that wouldn't come looking for you in a public toilet, or at least I thought so. And then when the time came, I took the train. On the train, of course, I had the scare of my life when the man standing next to me came over and said to me that, in French, of course, I know where you're coming from. And, you know, I almost emptied my gut, you know. It's but he very quickly reassured me and gave me my first meal in 9 months. You know, so, and then I got to Marseille, and my mother had given me the address of the OSE Bureau, and I found it. Once I was there, I felt safe.
And this was an organization, Le Bureau d'Ouvre de Secours aux Enfants,
yes,
which saved children. Was that, or was...
L'Ouvre de Secours aux Enfants was really established in the early 1900s, started in Russia, and it was aimed to help Jewish people in trouble. And it's now an international organization. And during that era in France, the OSE took the responsibility of seeing to it that the children in the camps were as well taken care of as possible, which was not an easy thing to do.
No.
The OSE also opened some homes for refugee children. There were already many children then who had lost parents, and then there were children who were separated from parents and that were placed in these OSE homes. And I was in the OSE home in Saint-Raphaël for a year.
Yeah, with other children,
obviously. Yes.
And I'm curious, and even again as a psychiatrist, but also someone who lived through this, and I don't know whether you thought of yourself as an orphan. I mean, I'm assuming you thought you would reconnect with your mother.
Oh, absolutely.
At some point, and I wonder whether the boys felt that way, boys and girls felt that way. But what do children need and want under those circumstances? I mean, here they are. A little boy escaping from a concentration camp makes his way to Marseille, and now he's in a place with other boys like himself.
Boys and girls.
Boys and girls.
Yes, and very wonderful social workers were in charge of the place. Madame Mazur was the chief social worker there, and there were a couple others. And it was quite a nice villa in southern France. Hmm. And they had classes for us. No, they didn't have classes for us. We eventually went to the public school in Saint-Raphaël.
Really?
Yeah, we walked from the Villa Mariana to the school in Saint-Raphaël. We played games, of course. You put a bunch of Jewish children together and you're going to know that they're going to be doing the horror and the dances and the...
But was there a need? Did you want, even as a young boy, to talk about what was going on? Do you think that is important for children under those circumstances, or not necessarily?
We didn't really talk so much. We all sort of knew that we were removed from our families. Many of us knew where our families were. Some didn't. And mostly we just lived.
Hmm.
You know, we just lived our lives.
Is this something that the people should think about? And under the sort of Holocaust circumstances in places like Sudan or other countries around the world that deal with this kind of misery and killing?
Well, I think that whatever questions children ask, adults ought to answer. They ought to measure how they answer in terms of, if a child asks a simple question, don't give them a book of an answer. You know, just use your judgment as to the level to which you want to answer. But I, as a child psychiatrist and analyst, I tell parents, tell your children the truth.
Right.
You know, don't, because they'll find out what's not true. And then you will have eroded some of their trust in you. Right. And that's not something to do. You know, maintain the trust. Tell them the truth. They can deal with it. You know, children's fantasies are much worse than the truth.
Hmm. Because of their vivid imaginations?
Oh, absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. I mean, a five-year-old will be certain that a bear is coming into the house,
right,
you know, during the nighttime having a dream. So imagination is much worse than the truth. And
even when dealing with something like the Holocaust?
Even when dealing with something like that, right. Yes. When dealing with starvation, you know, it's interesting that none of us complained about wanting more food. We knew that this is what there was. You know, and when we were in the OSE home, my favorite dish there was chickpeas, which I still love to this day. Now, you know,
good association, right?
Wonderful. And the fact is that starving in Rivesaltes was a horrible thing. Starving in the Villa Mariana was not so terrible. You know, so where you were starving was a big factor. Yeah.
You say something later on in the book, and then I do want to get to our callers and also pick up on your own personal story, that looking at children who have, you know, lived under dire circumstances, that you actually say that something like domestic abuse on a child is more painful than a Holocaust experience.
Oh, I'm so glad you give me a chance to talk about
right.
that.
And when a parent hurts a child,
yes,
that's worse than your
yes.
mother.
Yes. You know, here I am, a psychoanalyst. Now, as psychoanalysts, you know, you're supposed to stay as anonymous as you can to your patients. which is why I delayed, at least in part, in writing my memoirs. When I got to a certain age, I decided I had to write it. So now my patients, all, you know, those who have read my book, and I think most of them have, know what happened to me. And some of them come in to me and say, how can I talk about my problems with what you've been through? And the fact is that what I've been through, I was victimized by the enemy. You know, all the Jews of Europe knew that Hitler was determined to exterminate the Jews of Europe. He promised that. When a child is abused by his or her own mother or father, now that is very different. Mm. You know, you expect love and protection from your mother and father. And I tell you, and a colleague of mine, Anna Ornstein, who's also a survivor, a child psychiatrist, we both agree that children who are abused by their own parents suffer more than we suffered.
Even though, as you say, you were hungry, your mother, you know, I'm thinking of this as a parent myself, you know, if I couldn't get enough food for my child, or I couldn't keep them warm, or I couldn't provide some of the basic needs of children, you're saying the fact that the parent is there and loving them.
Absolutely.
Makes all the difference.
Makes all the difference in the world. And you can have the enemy, you know, shooting at you from a distance and promising to exterminate you, but you've got your mother that you love and who loves you, and you feel safe. When your own parents
abuse...
Even if you're not safe, even with bombs falling around you, you know. But if your own mother and your own father, or your own father, or both, abuse you, and let me emphasize, by the way, we all recognize the importance of physical abuse and of sexual abuse. But there is an abuse that I think is by far even more comprehensive, happens a lot more, and is more hurtful, and that is emotional abuse.
When you insult a child, hurt a child.
You know, you'll never amount to anything. You know, can't you get anything straight? I'm so ashamed of you. Do you know how much I suffered giving birth to you? Mm. You know, those things are just horrendous for children. It's much more traumatizing than what happened to me.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Dr. Henry Perrins, our guest today on Radio Times. He's a Philadelphia-based psychiatrist and psychoanalyst, and he specializes in the treatment of children. He's written a book about his childhood, how the experiences of the Holocaust shaped him as an adult, and it's also about resilience and parent-child relationships. The book is called Renewal of Life, Healing from the Holocaust. He's a professor of psychiatry at Thomas Jefferson University here in Philadelphia. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Well, let me go back to your personal story. And here you are living in this home in Marseille. And the people that run
outside of Marseille,
yes. Mm-hmm. And this organization decides that you and others, other children, are really better off if you're sent to another country, including America.
Well, the way that came about is that there were some social workers who had been permitted entry in Rivesaltes, in the concentration camp, and lived in the concentration camp. They had special facilities, but nonetheless they were there. They let the inmates at Rivesaltes know that if they wished to send their child to America, they ought to register that child on the list. From Rivesaltes, my mother put my name on the list. And so I was in Villa Mariana for about a year when I was informed that I was going to come to America. I thought, you know, wonderful idea. But again, the problem was that I was going alone.
Right, without your mother.
Right, and I came with 49 other refugee children in May and June of 1942.
Well, in fact, your mother saw you off.
Yes. How they managed it. And I've read the book written by the social worker who was in Rivesaltes, Yvette Samuel. And she wrote about getting a permit to bring the mothers to, and the parents to say goodbye to their children. They gave them permission for one day. We visited for no more than a few hours. I really do not remember our goodbyes.
I was wondering about that, really.
No, I absolutely do not remember that.
Right.
And they were sent back then to Rivesaltes. The fascinating thing in reading Vivette Samuel's account of this is that she wrote, and I don't mean to be pejorative about it, but she wrote that the children went off happily. Hmm. Well, I must say that that is not true at all. The children went off scared to death.
Because you were going to a whole new country and again alone without
and leaving,
your mother.
Leaving. You know, we're leaving our families, leaving right. our mothers, and going essentially right. with an adult couple chaperoning 50 kids.
You later found out that your mother died in Auschwitz.
When I got to the States, I went to high school here. Right. And all along, I was waiting to hear from my mother.
That's so heartbreaking.
And when I was a senior in high school, a friend of mine had come over with me, Savik.
Right.
And he had not escaped from Rivesaltes with me, but he came over on the same convoy as I did. He got news from his mother when we were in high school, saying that she and his father had survived, but that he needed to tell me that my mother had been sent to Auschwitz. And when I count back, it happens that my mother was sent to Auschwitz 3 months after I landed in America.
Hmm.
So all along, I thought that she was still alive. I still expected to hear from her. Did not. And, of course, used to badger the social service office to ask them if they'd gotten any news. And
did they not know?
They didn't know.
They didn't know, of all that was going on.
It was only those who were there knew who had been sent right. to Auschwitz, and many of us absolutely did not. And, you know, Rivesaltes became the hub from where Jews were sent to Auschwitz from southern France. You know, it's important to emphasize that this was not just Germany. You know, we were in France.
Right, Vichy France.
Vichy France, yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, free France.
Mm-hmm.
And the collaboration between the Vichy France government and the Nazis in occupied France could not be better. In fact, Vichy sent a transport of Jews to Drancy, which was the station outside of Paris from where they were then sent to Auschwitz, before the Germans were ready to receive them.
Hmm. So they were ready
That's
to get rid of them before they were ready to be received.
Some of the French were to get rid of the Jews.
Do you still bear resentment against the French or the French Vichy government or even the current government today?
No, not the current government. I bear unending resentment toward Nazis. I don't bear resentment toward the Germans because there were many Germans who were against all of this. Not all French were accomplices in this event, in this protracted event of many years. And as I said before, side by side with people doing horrendous things, there were also many people doing very good things, and there were many very good French who hid, Jews. And by the way, many of them not Jewish people, as you can understand.
Right.
Priests, ministers, organizations. You know.
Another short break, then we'll be getting back to our conversation with Dr. Henry Perrins, talking about his life and his work. He wrote a book about his life called Renewal of Life, Healing from the Holocaust, 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
I'm Peter Sagal. Tune in to hear veteran newsman Carl Castle relax and let his hair down on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the news quiz from NPR.
Saturday afternoon at 4 on WHYY.
Next time on Day to Day, he's part DJ, part news correspondent.
DJ Diplo can tell you what's happening along the Gulf Coast by listening to the music.
There's a lot of protest songs, and they're always really big on the radio. They're just passed around on CDRs and everything. It's just telling real experiences of what's happened there.
Putting an ear to New Orleans a year after Katrina, next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY. I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. America's key ally in the war on terrorism, Pakistan, is rocked by civilian unrest. Also, the lost boys of polygamy, young men kicked out of their homes by dads who see them as competition for future wives. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now. Today at noon on WHYY.
The Next Mayor, a groundbreaking multimedia project to explore the issues leading to the Philadelphia mayoral election. Your issues, your voice. Presented by WHYY, the Daily News, at the Committee of 70. To learn more, visit thenextmayor.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Henry Perrins. He's a Philadelphia-based psychiatrist, psychoanalyst. He specializes in treating children. We've been talking about his childhood growing up in Europe under the Holocaust. He came to the States as a young boy. Much of his family, many members of his family, died during the Holocaust. His mother died at Auschwitz. He works now teaching parents how to be parents, works on things like malignant prejudice, which I do want to talk about as well. And again, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Help us understand, and I can almost, I mean, you began your book by saying the Holocaust happened, and I know that it happened, but I wonder whether you even still struggle with the enormity of what the Holocaust was about and this idea that you can exterminate a whole race of people, a whole group of people. You can call them...
Fortunately, they couldn't do that.
Well, they couldn't do that, but certainly that was the intention, this idea to completely wipe people off the map. And we saw that in Rwanda, you know, and...
Oh,
and,
absolutely.
And other parts of the world.
Darfur. Absolutely.
How do you understand what then this kind of malignant prejudice is about?
That takes us to the point of where my work lies now.
Right.
I'm working toward attempting to find ways to reduce malignant prejudice. There are many factors that go into it, Marty. When people walk around with a load of hostility, we're always looking for somewhere to attach it. Given that much hostility is generated within our homes, like it or not, mm-hmm. most hostility that we experience comes from our own homes. But you can't discharge that hostility toward your own parents. You know, in the course of growing up, it's just impossible. Mm-hmm. So you walk around with a load of hostility, and we see a great deal of it in our streets. And many, many things can draw the hostility to it. Now, one of the very common phenomena is peer pressure and mm-hmm. peer activity and peer interaction. Oh, they don't say it this way, but let's displace our hostility that we feel toward our mothers and fathers toward our neighbor over there because he's a spick or because he's black or because he's a Jew. And this kind of can get organized as well. And one of the critical
ideology.
Yes, right? As an idea. And the most critical organizer is education. Hmm. And the fact that education is one of the greatest culprits of promoting malignant prejudice, whether it's ethnic bias, whether it's religious bias, whether it's racial bias. You know, children are taught to not trust, to dislike, to consider others inferior than those from our own groups. And, you know, you had this ethnic cleansing in Bosnia.
Yes.
Go on, you know, modeled on.
Yes, Srebrenica.
Certainly, you know, the probably took a lesson from the Holocaust.
Right.
And by the way, 11 million people were killed in the death camps. Of those 11 million, 3 million were Russian prisoners of war. Hmm. Well, now, prisoners of war, first of all, the Geneva Convention wouldn't allow that, but nevertheless, they were, however, enemies. But then the other 8 million were non-combatants, and 6 million of these were Jews.
Hmm.
And by the way, of those 6 million Jews, 1.5 million were children.
Who died in the death camps.
Yeah.
years ago, and this is an interview that has stayed with me and I think will stay with me my whole life. I interviewed a man whose father had worked in one of the Nazi death camps. His father was a German soldier, a member of the Nazi party. Mm-hmm. And he would describe a loving father, reading his children bedtime stories, doing the things that, you know, you would hope parents would do in raising their children. And I just, even to this day, sort of struggle with that disconnect. How can you go right. home and read your child a bedtime story and then go to work, so to speak, the next day and carry out the execution of a whole race of people?
It's mind-boggling. It really is. But it really takes sort of a split in the self, right. you know, to be a good father at home and to be a bad father or warrior outside right. At work. It is mind-boggling. Speaking of that, by the way, the children of the perpetrators really carry a great deal of the brunt of what their parents did. And there are some studies that have been done, and the gathering of survivors as well, children of survivors mm-hmm. and children of perpetrators coming together. A number of these groups have occurred, and it really is amazing how, as one offspring of a perpetrator said, you know, you retain your dignity and your pride. I walk around with shame.
Mm, because of what their parents
did. Because of what their parents did, yes.
Let me get to Tia from West Philadelphia to join us this morning on Radio Times. Hi, Tia. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
My mother is the only child of Holocaust survivors. Both my grandparents were in camps in Poland. Mm. And I've been developing a growing awareness throughout my life of the way that just the experience of being a child of survivors haunted her throughout her life. And I've been on my own journey of healing, trying to understand how that experience affected me as a grandchild of survivors. I know I'm aware that I walk around with kind of an underlying feeling of terror, or I have irrational fears that aren't always explainable. And I'm just curious if the doctor has had any experience working with children or grandchildren specifically of Holocaust survivors, and if you've noticed any particular effects that that experience has had on them.
It's a great question, Tia, and Dr. Perrins does have grandchildren of his own, but
yes,
I'd be curious what your thoughts are.
I have grandchildren of my own, and of course I have three sons, too, who were growing during their growing years. It's very impacting on them. It becomes part of their lives, just as it's part of my life. They struggle with it constantly. My dilemma is that, Tia, I want you to remember that it happened, mm-hmm. but I also would very much like for you to forget it. Hmm. It's a terrible dilemma that we survivors and our children and grandchildren experience. But I would say this, that, you know, there are horrible things that can happen in the world, Tia. But there are also very wonderful things that can happen in the world. And just as there are people who are destructive of others, there are people who are loving and caring toward others. And I don't think that we're living in a world where all we have is destructiveness. There is also a great deal of constructiveness that is going on, a great deal of effort, by the way, to combat destructiveness. I wonder if you might consider, Tia, joining some interfaith group, for example. Hmm. You know, one of the good things that's going on right now, there are many efforts at reducing malignant prejudice, and one of the very good ways is the interfaith groups that are mushrooming throughout the country. Also, you know, the UN is very interested in... Kofi Annan has declared a war on racism. Right. And so there are many efforts to combat that. And I would say to you, Tia, why don't you get involved in spreading the word that we need to prevent this kind of thing from happening, that human beings really are all, under the skin, we're all very much the same.
Thank you for calling into Radio Times, and good luck to you as well. But I wonder, even as a parent or a grandparent, as you say, it's important to tell the truth.
Yes.
But you don't want to burden your children with the truth.
That's quite right. You have to really use your judgment. I mean, you don't want to remind them every time you take a breath or every time you turn around. What we do in my own family, of course, now with my writing my book, it's become much more prominent in our daily life, and especially since I do a great deal of talking to high school kids and to kids and to different audiences about the Holocaust. But, you know, we allocated the holidays, Jewish holidays, as times to sort of remember. And that has, for me, as a survivor and as a parent and grandparent, that works well because the holidays generally carry some message of past traumatization and of hope, hope for the present, for the future, and also betterment of the present. You're right. You don't want to ram.
Mm-hmm.
And above all, one has to really be careful with how one communicates to one's children that we've been through this.
Right.
You know, I starved. Eat your food. You know, I starved. That's an absolute no-no. You know.
You took your family, including your grandchildren, to Rivesaltes in southern France, where you were interned with your mother. And it was your grandson who, you know, going through what's left of Rivesaltes, asked, so this is where you went to the bathroom?
Yes.
That was the thing that really struck him.
Oh, that really did, because, you know, that was an outdoor, of course, open bathroom, hole in the ground, you know, the old-fashioned, simple way. And he was so shocked by that. You know, he just came out of that.
I mean, of all the things there,
yes,
that was the one that really...
Yeah, he couldn't believe that we would be reduced to that, you know, that we had to just go to the bathroom and a hole in the ground.
Did you go through periods of bitterness in your own life or rage in your own life about what had happened, not just to you, but, you know, your mother died in Auschwitz, you lost other members of your family?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I was a very angry young man. I've had two psychoanalyses, you know, which have helped me enormously. But when I was in medical school, I went ahead in analysis because I was really a very angry guy.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately, I was able to, I think, mobilize some of my anger and put it to constructive use.
So channel it, into your work.
Into my work, yes. You know, development of aggression. What is aggression?
Right.
What can we do to reduce it? The parenting education to make sure that parents attempt as best they can to not abuse their own children. And now, the work of Malignant Prejudice. You know.
Did you ever go through a period where you questioned your faith or God?
Yes.
You know, how could God let this happen to me?
Do you mind
family?
If I read a brief passage?
No, not at all.
Excerpted from my book.
Sure.
You know, as I say in my book, the burdens of the parent really are visited on the children. And my problem with God and with liturgy, where is God? Why did God let this happen to us? God, too, was a victim of the Holocaust. Elie Wiesel said it better than anyone. Compelled to watch another hanging in Auschwitz, this time of a young teenager, too light to be effectively strangled by his own weight pulling on a hangman's noose. Writhing to breathe as he hung, it took 1.5 hours, and he stopped. Forced to watch, someone behind Wiesel asked in vain a second time, "So where is God?" Wiesel felt within himself a voice answering, "Where he is? Here he is. He is hanging here on this gallows." At the time of my writing, I said, I'm now 75. I still don't know about God. I'm not anti-God. I see God more as what I understand to be the God of Spinoza. God is in everything, everywhere. God cannot prevent Holocaust.
Because Holocausts are made by people.
Absolutely. God did not make the Holocaust. Mm. Human beings did.
You're working to try to, you know, deal with this problem of malignant prejudice, as you call it. Are you optimistic that we live in a world where something like that can be done? I mean, as you say, there's goodness in the world, there's badness in the world.
Well, it's not likely that we're going to totally eliminate it, but mm-hmm. we certainly can reduce it. And we certainly can prevent Holocausts of the kind that we saw, and then the Bosnia and Darfur and the killing fields of Cambodia and Rwanda. And I think that the world is really becoming more cognizant of these crimes against humanity. And I think that there are a number of efforts that are being made. And I have listed a number of efforts that can be made, starting with, if parents will stop abusing their own children, they will rear children who will be less loaded with hostility and hate that they walk around with. We need to do work in schools. You know, there's a lot of bullying in schools that goes on, which is horrendously destructive. A good friend of mine, Stuart Twemlow, has developed a program, an anti-bullying program. Mm. There are a number of anti-bullying programs in schools. I think teachers need to stop abusing children, students. Stop shaming students. If you want to get students to work, do it differently. Don't shame them. Mm. I want students to stop abusing teachers, you know. So that's within those contexts. And then there are the interfaith groups that are, I think, enormously important. They are mushrooming, more and more of them. And then the UN is now working against, war against racism. I could talk about that, you know.
I know you could, and we are out of time. And I thank you so much, Dr. Henry Perrins, for joining us today on Radio Times.
My pleasure.
And we've been talking about his book called Renewal of Life, Healing from the Holocaust. Dr. Perrins is a psychoanalyst, a psychiatrist here in the Philadelphia area, professor of psychiatry at Thomas Jefferson University, and joined us this morning on Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. Find out more about the program, including how you can leave us an email. Scotty Williams, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. My thanks to Dave Davies and Alan Tu for filling in while I was on vacation. Devorah Lissick and Susan Greenbaum produce Radio Times along with Alan Tu. And I'm Marty Moss Cohen. You're listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia, serving Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware, and worldwide at whyy.org.